Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
the award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Right now is one of the most important times in the 26-year history of Joy. Times are tough financially, but that will never stop us from delivering powerful, meaningful and uplifting radio for you. To get ready for the future, we're launching Joy Nation and we need your support to do it. So help Joy by asking your workmates, your next door neighbour, your mum, your dad, your siblings and of course your friends. Go to joy.org.au and make a donation to build Joy Nation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Tess.
Our next guest, of course, is the editor of The Conversation, Misha Ketchell. And we're going to have a broad-ranging conversation about a whole range of topics. Good morning to you, Misha.
Good morning.
Great to have you back on the airwaves.
Thank you.
How's working from home going, Misha? You're coping still?
I'm coping, but I think like everybody, it's starting to get a little bit old. I'm sitting here at the end of my bed with a dog snoring right in the front. But, you know, there's a certain point at which the idea of escaping to an office starts to appeal.
I've just got to say, have you seen that? I'm not going to name the company, but have you seen that ad, Misha or Tass, for the, I think it's an insurance company, and, you know, a lot of the people in their call centre are working from home, and one of them, the dog's asleep on her feet, and the other one, the cat's doing something, and, you know, you can ring us any time, you know. I identify with that, Misha. Tass?
Well, like you, Misha, I'm also feeling a little bit sick of working from home. One of the things that I enjoy about my work is meeting people and engaging with people and being able to occasionally have a coffee or a bite to eat and natter away. Yes, I am doing that via, you know, virtual technology, but it's not the same, really. It's wearing a bit thin for me, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
Anyway, Misha, we've got a whole range of topics that we'd love to chat with you about, but I want to start with one that appeared just over the last couple of days. And it was a comment that was made by our very own Prime Minister that was very soon retracted. And the comment was that no slavery existed in Australia and in Australia's history. What's your take on all of that?
Well, a couple of things. I think the first thing to say is that it was very good that Scott Morrison retracted that statement the following day on the Friday, and he said that when he made it, he was talking about the fact that when the colony of New South Wales was founded, there was no formal, you know, policy of, there was sort of a formal anti-slavery policy, which is true. But I think that the reality of history is that you've got to look not at what the formal policy is, but what the actual practice was. And I think his comments actually sparked a really interesting debate and discussion over the extent to which slavery was a very real part of Australia's history. We ran a piece by the academic Talia Anthony from University of Technology in Sydney.
Yes, we had Talia on the show last week, actually.
Great, fantastic. She's a terrific academic, and she did a great job of pulling together a lot of the evidence about slavery in Australia. And I think there are a few key things to understand, one of which is that slavery is very much a phenomenon that's based upon looking at the reality. And the definition of slavery really is any worker or any human being over whom another exercised rights of sort of ownership or control. And there's certainly extensive evidence that Indigenous pastoral workers, for example, for many years were treated in conditions that were pretty much tantamount to slavery. And the chief protector of Aboriginals, I think in the 1930s, made a statement saying as much. There's also, of course, the extensive history of what's known as blackbirding, where workers were imported, mostly into Queensland, sort of working on sugar plantations. And again, you know, that's pretty much widely seen as a form of slavery. So Australia does have a pretty deep and complex history of human beings being used and controlled by others, which is pretty much tantamount to slavery. And I think it's good that the Prime Minister corrected his comments. And in many ways, it's good that we've sort of had this discussion and we've had a good, long, hard look at this.
Mm. What about the politics of all of that? What do you think drove to the Prime Minister actually changing his position on this very issue?
Well, I think to some extent there wasn't really terribly much to lose by doing so. I'm not quite sure how deliberate the comments were originally, if there was some sort of, you know, if there was some sort of intent to sort of stir something up. I sort of doubt it. I feel like it may have been just a repetition of a fairly reasonably widely held misconception. There are some people that don't know this history as well as they should. So, you know, I think that it's actually good that he corrected the record, and I think it's good that the discussion take place. Sometimes I think on these issues, particularly in this moment where so much of the discussion is about racism and Black Lives Matter and these issues, there's a tendency to want to really hop into people who say things that are problematic or incorrect and really lay blame and, you know, label people as sort of racist. And in this instance, I'd like to give the Prime Minister the benefit of the doubt. I'm not sure that he had malign intent, and he was quite quick in correcting his comments. So, you know, for those reasons, I think, you know, you can sort of, you can be hypercritical if you want to be, and many people are being, but I would sort of see it more as a statement that needed sort of correction or amplification, and he was quite quick to do that.
Do you think, Misha, that, you know, perhaps the reality here is that he doesn't, and a lot of people don't know the history, the early history of Australia, that they don't actually know what blackbirding was. They actually don't know how Indigenous folk, you know, were treated because we weren't taught it in school. You know, particularly people of my generation, unless you actually went to search for this information, and it's often difficult to find, you don't have any knowledge of it.
I think that's true, and it's a spectrum of knowledge. So, I mean, I knew about blackbirding vaguely. I'd read things, I'd heard about it in different contexts, but I had to sort of go back and refresh my memory when this discussion came up. And I think it's true, this stuff wasn't taught in school. It certainly wasn't taught to me when I was in school. And I think the most valuable thing and the most important thing is being prepared to look hard at these uncomfortable truths about our history and about who we are and what we did. And the pleasing thing is that there have been people who have been willing to do that, and obviously there are some people who are less informed than others. But I think the fact that discussion was had this week was actually a valuable thing. And look, I'd sort of contrast that a little bit. There's been another discussion going on, which is a bit tangential, but I think it's worth raising, about the Collingwood footballer, Heretia Lumumba. I don't know if you saw any of the football on Thursday night, but after the game, the Collingwood coach, Nathan Buckley, in the press conference, actually brought up some comments made by Heretia, because Heretia had been critical of his time at the Collingwood Football Club. He'd said that he was a victim of a form of racism, that one of his nicknames was Chimp, that other Indigenous players and other people had verified his account of events, and that Collingwood had done nothing to acknowledge sort of what he'd been through and talked to him. And Buckley in that press conference actually said, look, you know, I'm keen to reach out to Heretia. You should come down to the club and see all the progress we've made. And immediately afterwards, it cut back to other Channel 7 commentators, and they're all like, oh, how wonderful is Nathan Buckley? What a, you know, what a great gesture, you know, reaching out, raising this issue, blah, blah, blah. And I thought to myself, hold it a second. Buckley has not admitted any of what happened. They haven't investigated. His position has consistently been the same as Nick Malthouse's and others, which is they're not aware of the nickname ever being used. Now, surely if you want to deal with racism in your culture, one of the things you need to do is actually face up to it. Yeah, you need to ask the question.
Exactly.
What happened? What was said? Was that name used? By who? Perhaps it was used in a way that at the time people thought it was sort of affectionate or gentle, and they didn't understand the racist overtones or the ways in which it might have made Heredia feel. But the idea that when somebody has had a negative experience and been a victim of racism, it's their job to come and be an audience to your PR exercise about how good you are now and just forget about what happened to them with no effort to make amends or even understand what happened, I thought was sort of appalling. And there was a real sort of, you know, for want of a better word, whitewash feel about the whole, you know, aren't we good now, aren't we doing better, which to me is a failure to face up to the reality.
Yeah. Now, we've got a message from a listener.
555.
555 says, I haven't heard the name Misha for many years. It reminds me of an old friend of mine called Misha McIntosh in Adelaide. There you go. You're not related because it's a Christian name, but there you go.
No,
Misha.
And there's not many Mishas around, actually. So
I have to confess, I'd never heard the name Misha till I heard of you.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Well, there's a few others. There's a Misha Schubert, who was a journalist
of course.
At Fairfax for many
years.
Yes. Was reasonably prominent. In fact, I recently was at a dinner and I sat at the same table with Misha, and I think it's the first time I sat next to a Misha. So
a Misha convention. A Misha convention.
Yeah.
I was actually at a dinner a couple of weeks ago and there were four Ians at the table.
Oh, God. One's enough, usually.
Four.
Well, one in particular.
Half the dinner guests were called Ian.
Ian, so when you said Ian, you had to...
And you're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 with Macca and Tass. Macca, what's the joke?
I don't know. Paul's the one who's laughing. Perhaps he's laughing at you.
Our guest is Misha Ketchell, the editor of The Conversation. So, Macca, what was the topic that you were going to drive?
Well, look, let's deal with SeatKeeper first, Misha. You know, job keeper, you know, kitchen keeper, you know, job seeker, you know, whatever it is. You know, the government is spending a huge amount of money. Pity they didn't use some of it to buy a calculator, but they're spending a huge amount of money to keep people employed through JobKeeper. They raised JobSeeker. You know, we've seen, I don't know, is it called HomeKeeper? You know, this this latest idea for, you know, renovations and building. But it seems it's a lot of money. How is this going to play out post-COVID? Because a lot of this assistance is scheduled to cease in September. Like a cliff. It's going to fall off a cliff. What are your thoughts?
Well, there are a lot of economists that are very concerned about this sort of cliff phenomenon, and they're arguing for a more sort of stepped decrease to some of these measures. I think the reality is we're going to need some economic stimulus for quite a bit longer yet. And there may be other things that are announced or other policies that are announced along the way that will sort of provide evidence of this. I've got to say that sort of the money that you sort of talked about as HomeKeeper, that sort of money for renovations to try to stimulate the economy, I think that the response from economists was that it was fairly badly targeted. It's going to have pretty low take-up and it's going to be quite ineffective. And most of the really knowledgeable economists have been arguing for, you know, money to be spent on infrastructure, public housing,
yes,
those types of things. It seems very much that the sort of the policies that we're seeing are driven by a particular ideological slant, a particular sense of the role of government and the role of sort of individuals and this desire to sort of hand money to individual households. When in actual fact, if you're wanting to stimulate the economy overall for the public good, there are better ways you could do it.
What an interesting concept, Misha.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's just, you know, we end up getting something that is somewhat second best. Just on that, just a little bit of a tangent, but something I did want to mention today. There was a great piece by Michelle Grattan, the political commentator, journalist, yesterday about the role of Senate committees and how important they are in our parliament. And basically, she sort of made the point that really this system, the current system we have of Senate committees was established, it's about 50 years ago now, and it's really where most of the work of government scrutiny happens. And the big thing about JobKeeper when it was realised that, you know, it's going to be, I think, 3 million rather than 6 million or whatever the figures were, and it was going to be a lot less money spent on it than was originally estimated, all of that really was scrutinised in a Senate committee.
Yes.
Michelle Grattan was sort of writing that given that there is such a poor approach to freedom of information, there's such tight control of information from government spin doctors, so little access to the public service, And that basically question time and, you know, much of sort of formal parliament is ineffective in sort of creating public scrutiny of government, that these Senate committees are doing a huge amount of really important work. And I think that's really interesting when you compare, for example, the parliamentary democracy we have in Australia with the UK, where there is a much more robust system of parliamentary scrutiny. If you look at question time, if you look at, you know, the House of Reps, really it's not functioning as providing that sort of accountability for government that you would want it to, because, you know, obviously government controls the numbers. And it's interesting that at least that work's going on through the Senate committee.
You're not suggesting by any means that the Senate committees will change because they are providing this level of scrutiny?
Well, you would hope not. It's interesting. I mean, in the article that Michelle Grattan wrote, she talked about the fact that public servants will talk when they're designing policies, you know, to meet sort of government needs around how will this play in a Senate committee. Yes. Because the Senate committee is the only place that the politicians can actually drill down to a meaningful level of detail to really scrutinise something properly. And there is so much really good and important work that happens before those Senate committees. It actually influences the whole way the work of government is done in a really positive way. So if you're saying, you know, would a government want to diminish the power of Senate committees, I think there would be a very strong incentive there. Let's hope that they're not effective in making it happen. Mm.
And, of course, in those Senate committees, sometimes, you know, things happen. I mean, this week, Senator Murray Watt forgot his microphone was live and he was talking to a colleague about, I managed to get a question in about robo-debt or whatever. You know, that was pretty good. And the chair of the committee, who was actually a Labor senator, I can't remember her name, was interjecting saying, Senator Watt, you need to meet your microphone, because everyone's hearing what a tool you are. But I do love watching the Senate committees because you know that they're actually getting to the nub of the matter, particularly with bureaucrats, you know, whether it's Mike Pezzullo or some of those others, that when they get a bit agitated, you know, when they start being a bit of a smart ass, because the question is actually getting to the nub of the matter. Mm. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think the Senate committees are so important. But any government of any colour, when they're in opposition, yeah, they think the Senate committees are great. When they're in government, they think they're a blot on the landscape.
So. Okay, gents, I think we should move subjects. Let's move right along. Let's talk about Trump. Misha, what are your current reflections on what's happening in the US? Where do you start?
Well, is he going to get re-elected? Do you think he can be re-elected, Misha? That's what we all fear, or perhaps not fear.
Every now and then you ask me a question about what's going to happen in politics, yeah, and I always think you just got to be totally crazy and incredibly foolish to make any prediction. The business of prediction should be left to, I don't know, bookies or somebody else. I don't know. I do not know what is going to happen in the US. It's a hugely complex moving system. You know, all I know is what I see in terms of the news reports about the just, you know, consistently concerning lack of leadership from the president in terms of the way he talks, his divisive language. I mean, that stunt where the, he held up the Bible, I mean, all that sort of stuff. It is appalling and deplorable, and you can see all of the ways in which disrupts the whole political system and destroys any chance of productive, collaborative, good outcomes. So, you know, I think it's a chaotic presidentship. I think everyone agrees it's very, you know, deeply concerning. But where it's going to go, it's very hard to know. Joe Biden seems a reasonably appealing candidate. He is, what is it, 74?
Yeah.
Or 77. No, I think he's 77.
Oh, he's seen as a reasonably poor public speaker, underwhelming in many ways, acceptable across the Democrats, but not necessarily going to have great cut-through. So there is quite a bit of concern about his capacity to take on Trump. And I guess we'll have to wait and see.
What would another Trump presidency mean for the world?
I think it would be disastrous. I can't think of anything worse. Now that if Trump were to be elected with everybody now knowing what they know about his erratic, irrational behaviour, his sort of microaggressions, his chaotic leadership, the sort of the destruction he's wrought across so many spheres of public life and society, I think it would just be disastrous, geopolitically in particular. I think it would have a huge global effect. And we're already seeing a lot of that trouble washing through in so many ways. So, you know, and there are many people, for example, on the Republican side, there's some quite principled Republicans who are basically arguing the same thing. They think that the Trump presidency has been a disaster.
And I think, you know, that the issue here, Misha, is if we look back to the last presidential election and about a month before when, you know, hardly a particular date in time where necessarily where Trump had made an appalling statement, because you can basically go to any day or any week, but that was where the infamous pussy comments got aired. And right across the Republican Party, people came out and spoke out against him. Even Mike Pence, took him 2 days. But Trump recovered from that and was elected. So you have to ask, well, is he, you know, can he beat Biden? Is Biden energising the vote? And I think I'm concerned that people are not going to get out there and vote. And Americans have a history of not voting. You know, only slightly more than half of Americans eligible to vote actually vote. So, you know, Trump, you know, he knows how to play this. At the moment, yes, he's behind in the polls, but he was behind in the polls a month out from the last election too. Who knows what's going to happen? We can't predict it, can we?
No, and I think that what you're saying is absolutely right, in that because of the voluntary voting in the US, mobilising the base is hugely important. Trump is very good at that, and he's very good at nodding and winking to all sorts of different constituencies of supporters. So that's a very real concern. I've been listening to a fantastic New York Times podcast called Down the Rabbit Hole.
Yes.
And it's about the ways in which, in particular, YouTube has spread, you know, conspiracy theories and misinformation, you know, far-right groups, things like QAnon, which was sort of the group of sort of conspiracy theorists that were behind Pizzagate, and the way in which, for example, at Trump rallies, you know, the reporters go to Trump rallies and they can find QAnon supporters who believe these crazy theories. And there are certain ways Trump nods to them, you know. In fact, there was one comment he made, apparently, which was about there being a storm coming, and there's always interviews with these QAnon people sort of speculating about what the storm is. I mean, it is utterly irresponsible for a president of a country such as the United States to say something like, there's a storm coming,
yes,
but you're not going to say what it is or what it means. Or because, of course, when you're in a leadership position, people will speculate, they'll fixate on that, they'll start to develop their theories around it. I mean, any responsible president would either say something genuine to the people and be transparent, or not say something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, we are in a world of absolute unleashed craziness.
Mm.
It's very dangerous. It's very febrile. It's concerning. And I don't know what's going to happen. I don't think anybody does.
Now, you know, the Secret Service, whenever they're driving Trump anywhere, they won't go anywhere near a dog pound. He's such a dog whistler.
Made that up, Macca. That's a bad joke.
He's such a dog whistler that if he did, they'd all be jumping out over the fence. Anyway.
Misha, thank you for your time this morning. It's always great to have you on the airwaves. Great conversation. Keep up the great work. And thanks for being available again.
Thanks. And perhaps there'll be one day I can come into the studio again.
We hope so.
Well, hopefully in July.
I think in July.
Yeah, depending on what advice we get from the Chief Health Officer in the next week, which I expect there will be some further advice next week.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
So,
thanks very much.
Stay well and give the dog a pat, Misha.
I will do.
Okay.
Thanks.
Saturday Magazine is proudly sponsored by Velocity Rewards, the loyalty program of Virgin Australia.